This is Filming the Supernatural. Welcome back, everybody. This is your host, Ben Goldman, and this is another one of my favorite interviews I conducted for the show. I'm speaking with the acclaimed writer, researcher, host, storyteller, Jeff Bellinger. He's created and worked on countless projects. The focus of our discussion, though, was on the two-time Emmy-nominated series, New England Legends. Without further ado, here's Jeff Bellinger, starting things off with a little backstory on the road to creating a two-time Emmy-nominated series.
So I'm born and raised here in New England, and I knew Ed and Lorraine Warren from a young age because I grew up in the town next to them. And they were, of course, featured in all the Conjuring movies, their work, and they were portrayed. And I started as a journalist, and I started writing feature stories for newspapers and magazines around October. And that eventually turned into a website back in 1999 called ghostvillage.com. And then I started writing books. My first book came out in 2004, and I've written 15 since. And then in 2008, I was approached by Zach Bagans from Ghost Adventures to work on that show as a researcher, writer, and help with locations and things like that. So I've worked on every episode of Ghost Adventures that's ever aired since 2008. And then, I do my own projects. So in addition to being, you know, interviewed for other networks and other TV shows, I started New England Legends with a partner from PBS back in 2012. We started, it was like an offshoot of a documentary. And New England Legends is really, it's our side hustle. You know, it's a labor of love. Everything we do with it is basically like begging friends for favors, you know, friends who like are shooters or sound people or musicians who compose or graphics folks, right? Like we're trading favors and things like that. Super small group. And what's great about it is that there's really only two people that we have to answer to when it comes to the content. It's myself and my partner, Tony Dunn. And so we also have to pay for it, which, you know, that's the downside, you know, is that PBS didn't give us any money. And when they air it, PBS doesn't give us any money. So PBS, various stations started running these shows we were producing. And it was cool. Like, so Tony's like, oh, I want to submit us for some awards. And I was like, it costs money. And like, what the heck, man, we're losing money on this thing. And so Tony did it anyway. And we were nominated for a regional Emmy, which was amazing. Right. I was like, holy cow, we're now like forever the Emmy nominated show. And then another episode got nominated for an Emmy. And so we're 2-time losers, which is awesome. But how many people can say that? Probably quite a few.
But they can say they were 2-time nominees. So
right.
There's that angle of it.
You're an optimist, I guess, Ben. Like, that's it. I look at it as like 2-time loser. So but anyway, no, it's been such a great experience. And so you know, we kept producing these things for PBS, but because we own them, we were able to put them on Amazon Prime. And Prime is where we actually did recoup our money. It's not wildly profitable, but like, you know, we're at least profitable now. We're not in the red anymore. And so it's just been really cool, though, to like, you know, because my partner Tony works full time as an executive producer at PBS. That's his day job. My day job is Ghost Adventures and like books and my other projects. And we get to collaborate on this thing that's just been, you know, like I said, a labor of love. And we just started filming a second season this year.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned a lot of your other work, not all of them in the film space, like books or podcasts. But I know you have done some other video type projects in the past, like 30 odd minutes.
So they're all on YouTube. Oh, my God. That's so funny. So today, I mean, here we are like zooming, and I know it's just audio, so no one can see this. But yeah. We take it for granted, like StreamYard and stuff like that, that allows everybody to stream on Facebook and YouTube. So back when I did it, there was the local cable access station. And let's be honest. At any given time, there are 3, possibly 4 people watching a cable access channel. I don't care what town you're in, and I don't care what anybody thinks.
I used to work for one, so I understand.
Yeah. So, you know, like you could put like, I mean, I know of a cable access station where literally the local fire department, they had like a VCR and they could play something on the community access channel. And by mistake, they literally had pornography playing in their fire department, just watching it for themselves and didn't know it was being broadcast. And it took quite a while before someone called because no one was watching. Anyway, so we went to our cable access station. And I'm like, look, I have a lot of friends who are pretty big names in the paranormal. But the problem is, like, they're not going to come here. It's not worth it. I've been a guest on a lot of the radio shows and stuff. And I'm like, it's not worth it for me to go somewhere for their cable access channel. You're not reaching anybody. And then Skype was around and we thought, like, all right, how do we integrate this thing? So we tinkered all afternoon one day and we were able to get Skype into the board. We said, all right, we can do stuff with this. We could get a guest from anywhere in the world, Skype them in and do like a real talk show that's actually worth it. And so then it sort of evolved into like this spaceship and it was super fun. That was also a labor of love. So we took the show, it was on YouTube. And then there's something called pegmedia.org, which is a website where people can upload their content. And so public access stations around the country that have like maybe 6 or 7 hours of original programming, which is just like the old guy who's cranky about taxes yelling at the camera, right? you remember
yep,
him.
Yep. One of those in every town.
Every town has it, right? Anyway. So these stations could download the content, and we always made sure we didn't say where we were. It was timeless. It was meant to be, you know, played anywhere. And then like hundreds of stations started playing us. So you have 3 or 4 viewers on hundreds of stations. It starts to add up. And then we had the live stream viewers, and then we had the YouTube downloads. And so suddenly we sort of built like this little cult audience. We were kind of like the, you know, Mystery Science Theater 3000, if they had never made it.
Right.
You know, it's one of those projects. People still ask me about it. It blows my mind because I think our last episode was, I mean, it might have been like 2013 or so. I mean, it's been like almost a decade. But it's one of those things where, like, I know we could resurrect it, but if I did, like, I'd want to do it. I would want to change the game again, right? I don't want to do what everybody's doing. I don't want to. I never do in my career. Like everything, you know. And then everybody started doing what I was doing, and then I'm like, okay, well, you know, now what? If I think of a way to do it bigger and better, that mothership's going to get resurrected one day, I promise.
Really was ahead of its time. I mean, bringing it back to New England Legends really seems like it sets some of the groundwork for some of your more visual projects you've done.
Just so everyone's clear, like I don't consider myself a filmmaker. I'm a storyteller, but I can appreciate when something works. And I don't know why it works technically all the time, but Tony could figure that out, which is why we're good partners. And I focus on story. So I already work for like the most popular ghost hunting show on television, Ghost Adventures. Like it is the highest rated hands down and has been forever. It's night vision, you know, like moving through the dark. It's great. It's great for what it is. The fans love it. And but at the same time, I'm like, when we started this, I'm like, I don't want to do night vision. I want to, but how do we take people into the story? You know, how do I get you there? Which by the way, is the question I ask every time a story comes across my desk, whatever that story may be. I ask myself, is this a podcast? Is this a book? Is this an article? Is this a tweet? Is this a selfie video in front of a grave where I'm like, look, I'm at the vampire's grave? Or is this worthy of like television production, like bringing in the whole crew? You know, and really, you know, doing it right. And over time you get more experienced in listening to the story, right? You let the story dictate that always, because books are fantastic. I can get into details that you just can't get in the visual medium. Visual medium gives you great visual details, but no meat as far as like content. That's just how it goes, right? I've always told people, if you watch like a 3-minute news segment on any news channel, whatever, cable or network or whatever, that's like, I don't know, what, 160 words? If you were looking at a single sheet of paper, it would be like half a page of single spaced text. That's it. That's all you get. And you're getting the editorializing of the talking head. Like, here's a story. They roll their eyes and now you're not supposed to believe whatever comes out of their mouth next. So you're getting the least amount of information, but I get that you're being visually stimulated, which is important and great too. The book can't give you that visual, wow, here we are with a drone from above this old, you know, Civil War era fort. And here's this, like, looking down these corridors and getting these funky angles with fisheye lenses and stuff like that. Can't do that with a book. Totally get it. So how do we tell the story? How do I take you into it without like the sensationalism of like, here's night vision and you're going to have to, you know, believe I'm seeing a ghost or not. And so that was the thing like Tony and I just talked about ad nauseum. Like, how do we do it? Well, we know we want to talk to people who've had the experience, because the chances that we're going to go there, set up all our lights, all of our cameras, and the ghost is going to appear while we're shooting. I mean, you know, lightning could hit too. I mean, it's possible, but you know, it's unlikely. And so we want to talk to the people that have had the experiences. One thing I have learned from Ghost Adventures is recreations. A good recreation of a paranormal event leaves a lot to your imagination, right? That's a good one. You should show way too little, not too much. You know, like an awkward camera angle, like just a shadow moving, does so much more for the creep factor than if you had like an unlimited budget in CGI. And this is a super old reference, but like the movie Jaws, the reason we never saw the shark is because it was so low tech, it looked cheesy. And then who knew, not seeing the shark made him twice as scary as if you did see the shark. You know, you have to sort of remember that minimalist approach, especially when you're going for like a little bit of like eerie factor. You know, you're kind of like trying to set that stage. So how do you unfold the story and where do you land? Like, you know, I'm asking you to come for a ride with me, you know, so how do I pull you into that ride? And then how do I make you satisfied that we actually got somewhere? I think sometimes we succeeded better than others. But that's any story. You're just, you know, and then the worst part is when you look back and you go, oh, I want another crack at that. Right. I could do it better now. We got smarter. You know, that was
right.
You know, that was years ago. So, always learning.
Were there any stories in particular that just got pushed right to the top because you thought they would really benefit from the visuals you get from film, or vice versa? Were there any that you held back because perhaps they'd work better as a book or a podcast?
Yeah. So there's, for example, there's a great ghost ship story out of Marion, Massachusetts called the Mary Celeste. It's a ship that literally like sailed itself across the ocean. The crew was missing. Nothing was stolen. Like there was still food in there and everything. So, you have to sort of put your mind into the context of the times, right? In the 1800s, you don't get out of your boat in the ocean unless you think you're going to die if you stay in it. Because if you get out of the boat, the chances of you dying go through the roof, astronomical, right? Like in the middle of the ocean, like your boat is all you have, your ship. And this ship was empty, nothing stolen. And the whole crew's gone. It still puzzles people. Like, what the hell happened to the Mary Celeste? Great story. And I can take you right to where about the docks would be that it would have left in Marion, Massachusetts. And that's all I can show you. The boat's long gone, right? Like, it's all the people are long dead. We don't even have ships that look like that anymore. So all I can do is like stand at an oceanfront and say, here is where the dock was that this incredible boat, right? And so... And you don't want to watch me point at the ocean and tell you what it would have looked like. A podcast, though, you know, I add in a little ocean waves, seagulls, sound effects that bring in theater of the mind. You can hear the creaking boat. You can hear the wood as it, you know, groans in the water. And we can tell that story for literally like $4 in sound effects that we can reuse another time, you know, like that's the crazy thing. So, you know, again, sometimes there's nothing to show you. So why bring the cameras out? Sometimes the story is so good, but there's nothing to show you. So we'll make it a podcast. And sometimes we've done both where like, you know, it started on the podcast because the podcast doesn't require film permits. It doesn't require insurance. It doesn't require you to rent a police officer who's going to do absolutely nothing except destroy your budget, you know, because there's nothing for him to do, right? Like these exorbitant costs that come up, you know, when you're trying to film in some locations that make it so prohibitive because it's just so expensive. And so, sometimes we've done podcasts where we're like, okay, this is visual. This is, and not only, oh, someone's got like this old, these old photos that we can show, we can put those on the screen. We can pan and zoom. We can, interview this person. We can find, you know, this blanket that still exists from 200 years ago that was attached to the person in the story. And so, you know, you're always sort of wondering. What I like about the podcast especially is that it can almost be like a testing ground for show segments. You know, like we can work the story out there and then, oh, hey, you know what? How do we do this visually?
Now, when you're working out a story in the paranormal space, what are you thinking about in terms of structure? Like a particular framework, like the 5 W's or something like that to help wrap your brain around some of the complexities or perhaps unresolved aspects of some of these legends?
A good ghost story is told this way. And I didn't invent this. I just observed it. And it's a tried and true formula. The recipe works every time, right? This place is haunted. It's haunted. They say it's haunted by the ghost of a little girl. Whoa, there's your lead, right? Ghost of a little girl haunts the attic of, you know, 1865 restaurant on Main Street. Okay, I'm listening. Well, now I want to know, who was that little girl? Why is she haunting this building and not the next building? Why is this building haunted and not the one across the street? It's even older. And so over time, what you do now is then you go back in time and you have to backfill. Well, this building was built here. Who built it and why? Who lived here? Who died here? What kind of tragic events took place? And then sometimes you can pinpoint the tragedy. You can say, wow, we've got this newspaper article. A girl did die right on the train tracks right over here and was carried to the nearest building, which was this one. And now people still, you know, report the ghost. So you start with the now, the ghost, you go back in time, you can, and then you try to discover, that's the mystery, right? Who, what, when, where, and then why. The why is because we can't let her go, right? That's any haunt ever, anywhere in the world. Why is it haunted? Because we can't let the story go. And when I say we, I mean the community that around that haunt. It's not up to me or you which place is haunted and which is not. It's up to the community that talks about certain places because there's some unfinished business in the story, right? Two people were murdered in that house. No one was ever punished for it. That haunts us. I don't care that it was 100 years ago and everybody involved is now dead. It haunts us that someone got away with murder, and we're going to keep talking about it because we know it could happen again today. And so, that's sort of the formula. And answer what you can answer, leave it open what you can't, you know, and that's just being truthful. And in the end of the day, like, I mean, good art is just truth, right? That's all art is something that rings true to lots of people. The more people it rings true to, the more successful the artist. But that's what it comes down to.
Are there any that really ring true to you?
Yeah, it's funny how, like, so for me, because yeah, I've been doing this 25 years now, you know, like weird stories, not just film, but like, you know, and so at this point, I've become a magnet for them, which I'm grateful. Like my inspiration, I open my email and I'll get like a couple emails a day that are like, hey, have you ever heard about like this really weird tale up in Maine? And I'm like, no, I haven't. But, you know, and sometimes you read it and you go, okay. Yeah. You know, all I can tell you is that when a story calls to me, it's a physiological feeling in my stomach. My stomach literally lurches a little bit. And sometimes it lurches a lot, where someone will be telling me like, hey, you know, there's this, this old well house out in the woods where the Shakers say, if you drank the water, you'd be immortal. And I'm like, it's still there, right? There's something we can see. It's not just like it used to be there. Like the old stone structure is still there. Yeah, I've seen it. I could take you to it. And I'm like, can we go now? Right? Like you get excited. And not only that, I don't usually write stuff down. You know, if I keep thinking about it, like the next day and the day after that, I'm just like, well, I got to deal with this. It's not leaving me alone. And so for me, it's waiting for that reaction that like, oh, there's something here. And that's experience, right? That's just like a chef after a number of years can probably look at certain cuts of meat or whatever and be like, that's a good one. That's mediocre, right? You just get an eye for it over time. And so once you've got that physiological feeling, then the next question is like, where do we start? Like, how do we, and the good news is no story starts at the beginning. Thank God, right? The pressure's off there. No story you've ever heard starts at the beginning, but where do we choose to jump in is the next question. And so for me, that goes back to journalism days. How do I grab you? What's the lead? You know, what's the thing that, you know, like, oh, you see that Stone Hut behind me, or, you know, in that case, that's the Shaker Medicinal Spring Water, which is one of my favorite stories. There's an ad from like the 1880s that said, you know, Moses smote the rock. This water smites disease and death. And you're like, what? And it said, like, you know, it'll cure any disease you have. It's this mineral water. It's amazing. And you say, well, this is before the days of truth in advertising. So, you know, they could say whatever they want. But then we went from that ad to the cemetery, which is a unique cemetery in Harvard, Massachusetts. And all these headstones said, like, died age 96, age 98, age 101, age 89. This is the mid 1800s when the average life expectancy was like half of that. And so now you have to say, whoa. And of course, I already know, as the storyteller, we have a visual payoff. That old stone hut is in the woods, and we're going to get there. And I'm going to take you there. Stay with me, right? I will get you there. And not only that, we went with the whole Harvard Historical Commission that, like, it hadn't been opened in years, and they brought every key they had. Like, we were getting this thing open. And we finally get there. We open it. There's still water coming up, you know, through the old silty sand, just a few inches. And I brought champagne flutes, and I filled it with the water, and I drank it. And I haven't aged since. So, you know, I think I've got that going for me. But that was like, to me, that's the perfect story, because I've got the ad from the 1800s. We've got the headstones that you can say, like, whoa, these people lived a really long time. The Shaker houses that are still there are very visual and really cool. And they look old fashioned. Like, they look, oh, I can see what it must have been like to live there in the 1800s. And then boom, we trek into the woods, and we can still find this old, you know, water well. And like, to me, that was just sort of like the perfect story, a wild story with some strange evidence to back it up, and a payoff in that we can still get to the same water that those Shakers used to sell. Well, and the other part too, is that, right, like, you, the viewer, couldn't have gotten in there without me, right? Like, I made that happen for you. I had the contacts. I arranged it. I got the door open. You might have been able to find it in the woods, but you wouldn't have got the door open, right? I got the door open. I literally drank it for you, you know? And that's to me, like, that's the point of, like, of a host. That's the point of a story, is like, get me in somewhere that I couldn't get into, or show me a side of something that I didn't know about, right? Like, think of any travel series you've ever seen. Like, okay, sure, anyone can go to New Orleans. Anyone can go to Detroit. Anyone can go to New York. But show me something off the beaten path. Like, we've all seen Times Square in New York. Like, show me, like, all right, if we go down this alley, there's this little bar that, like, only the locals know about, and we're going to get in. And I'm like, oh, cool. Right. Like, now I'm seeing something that only someone in the know could get to. And then you feel like you're getting in on a secret. And that to me is like, that's TV storytelling, right? The guy that brought back Doctor Who, the producer. Oh God, Stephen Moffat. I saw an interview with him once, and he's my, like, my visual storytelling hero. And he said, I have a secret to tell you, and I'm going to tell you, but I'm only going to give it to you in little bits. And then at the end, I will finally reveal it all. And I was like, oh, that's it. Right. Like, that's what storytelling is. Like, I have a secret, and you are trusting that I will give you that secret if you invest the time with me, right? If you stay with me, and that it'll be worth hearing the secret. And that's, if you think about any good story you've ever heard, right? Something pulled you in where you were like, oh, I want to know what happens here. And they give it to you in little bites until you're like, I just keep feeding me. I need more of it, you know? And then in the end, you're just like, oh, that was awesome. What a great meal. Thank you, chef. You know? And that's what good storytellers do.
And I imagine another compelling aspect of storytelling is who is telling it.
Right.
Now on New England Legends, you're the host. Is that a role you've always been comfortable embracing?
So it started when I started writing books, I would be asked to speak about them. And I discovered that my favorite thing in the world still is speaking in front of a live audience. Because if you watch a show that I've worked on, I don't get to sit in your living room with you when you watch it and see your reaction. And, like, you know, because it'd be awkward anyway, because I'd be looking at you the whole time and you're looking at the screen. I'm like, is that good? Did you like that? Was this okay? Yeah, I know that could have been better, right? Like, I know, but imagine if we had more budget, we could have done this, right? So it'd be terrible for both of us. So public speaking is great because when it's working, they lean forward and you can feel the energy of the audience and you can see them react. And so I loved speaking about the stories that I researched. And so for me, like, the camera was the next, you know, iteration of that. It's funny because, like, New England Legends, like, I've learned a lot in 10 years. Like, some of those, they're literally, we filmed them 10 years ago. And I think I've gotten a lot more comfortable in how to address the camera over time. And, you know, I've done a lot more things since. Like, I look back at some of those things, I'm like, oh God, man, just trying too hard. You know, it's more of a conversation. And it took a while to realize that you're only supposed to talk to one person. I mean, no one tells you that when you first start getting in front of a camera, that you're actually only talking to one person. That's so important, right? Because then everyone will feel like they're that person. If you do it right, if you hit it good, you know, like, someone will feel like it's just you and me, you know, like, that's when you really connect. If you start thinking about lots of people watching, I don't know, you get in your own head at that point. So it's interesting, right? So I've worked on documentaries for other, you know, like Discovery Channel and stuff, right? Most of the time you're looking at a producer who's just off camera. So I'm talking like this the whole time because I think most people get uncomfortable looking at the little dot, the little lens, and then it comes across as unnatural. A few documentaries, once in a while, they'll ask you, no, just look right at the lens. And I've done it enough now that it's not so weird for me anymore. And by the way, for 2 years, all of us have done it on Zoom, right? You know, the rookies, when they're looking at the screen down here instead of looking at the camera. And we just sort of all learned that, you know, over the last couple of years and got more comfortable with communicating this way. We should all be better on camera now. We all had 2 years of practice.
And also the accessibility of it.
Well, so also too, like, you know, by the way, we're now competing. We're not just competing with, you know, like production crews and Discovery Plus and streaming channels. Man, we're competing with, like, you know, the selfie TikToker, right? That's just like, hey, I'm here at this thing and blah, 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 you know, and like, your phone is a great camera. Like, it's, you know, HD, the whole bit, you know, some of them are 4K now. And so, like, you know, you've got people that have gotten really adept at the selfie video, and they've become like TikTok and YouTube stars and have, by the way, more viewers than a lot of cable channels, right? A cable, like, some of these things, 4 or 5 million views. I mean, that's a lot. That's significant. Like, the cable channels would kill to have that many views on some of their shows. They're not pulling those numbers in. And so so the reality is, some people are obviously quite good at it. And that's why they have so many TikTok followers, and people pay them a ton of money to just be like, I drink Coca-Cola, right?
So with all these new platforms and the changing ways that people engage with content, like, yeah, on their phones or through streaming, yeah, services, as opposed to basic cable television,
yep,
is that something you're thinking about when prepping your current projects?
I literally would think of cable access, Discovery Plus or PBS as the same, in that I'm thinking about you watching it on a decent sized screen, right? If you're making something for YouTube, I'm thinking about you watching it on your phone. And so I might as well film it on my phone, right? I mean, because that's where we're at anyway. So I think you do have to be conscious. One nice thing that happened with streaming, by the way, which is where everything's going. I mean, the cable channels are going to go away. And, you know, as soon as sports starts offering streaming services, NFL is almost the last thing holding up networks. You know what I mean? Because as soon as NFL says, we're going to just do our own stream, so many people are gone. You know, I can watch my team and my sports. I don't care about, you know, I don't remember the last time I watched broadcast TV. Seriously. Like, all I watch is like streaming. But anyway, so you produce, the one nice thing about streaming, when you're producing for PBS, you've got act breaks. Same with, like, when Travel Channel, right? You have this many minutes and then you have to stop. And the show has to be this many minutes and this many seconds. It can't be 1 second over or 1 second under. Streaming, which is really cool, editors are thrilled. You know, writers are thrilled. I mean, think about whatever favorite shows you watch on streaming, right? One episode could be like 42 minutes. The next one could be 57 minutes. And the one after that could be 38 minutes. It doesn't matter, right? It works for you. And that's what they needed to tell that story. So I know editors are thrilled because they've had to kill like great stuff to hit time marks. You know what I mean? Like so to have those constraints taken off, I mean, sure, you don't want to, if you're watching a show, you don't want to watch like one episode's 40 minutes and the other one's 2.5 hours. Like that's
right.
That's going to inconvenience your audience, but you've got room to play. Whereas forever in TV history, you have not. So that's kind of cool that there's, I'll tell you what, it's a great time to be making content. You know, you have so many outlets, so many ways to monetize it. You know, Tony and I, it's just us, right? We don't have to fund a whole production company for our project. So we can make money off of Amazon Prime and it's worth it. You know, it's worth our time and investment. And then also like I get speaking gigs, like people pay me to talk about these weird stories all over. And my research on the show and my research in the podcast feeds those stories. So, you know, so I monetize it in other ways. If we had to like, you know, have a full-time, you know, shooter, a full-time sound person, a full-time editor on staff, would be dead, right? We'd have to hit a lottery to be able to afford that. So how cool is it that we can do this in our spare time with our spare money, get nominated for 2 Emmys and make enough money that it's worth it to keep doing it?
You see, we just came full circle here because that's the optimism that was missing in the first minute of this.
You're an optimist, I guess, Ben.
I can be.
Oh, I'm totally optimistic. It's a great time. Like, so there's incredibly talented people. And when I talk about like the TikTokers with 4 million views, I'm not looking down at them. They've got some lightning in that bottle. Don't take my word for it. Take the 4 million views word for it, right? It doesn't matter if you think it's stupid. A lot of people enjoy watching it. And so, so whatever that magic is, they've got it. And so, I mean, it's not my preferred medium, but so what? Like, I'm not the target audience anyway. So I think like now is just the most amazing time to be jumping into production because like, but the one principle I stand by is that you have to let the story dictate everything. You have to like, if you serve that master and that master alone, you'll be okay. You'll be fine. Because, you know, when you serve the master that is the story, I think that just trickles down to everything else. The audience gets what you're trying to do. You know, and then you'll have an audience. How big is it? That audience will be, how much money you'll make. I don't know, you know, but I do think that's my one guiding principle is just let the story lead. The mistakes that I think you can make are maybe you have a theme or a moral and you're trying to wedge the story into that theme or moral. That point you will fail. And I mean, we can both think of dozens of examples of stuff that you might've paid money to see in theaters where they're like, I'm going to make a movie for everyone. Oh, are you going to fail? You're going to fail so badly. You're going to make the worst piece of crap ever, right? Because nothing is for everyone. Go find me one thing that everyone likes besides pizza, right? Like, you know, I mean, like, so like, it's just, forget it. Like make something that you love, make something that serves the story and the rest will just kind of work itself out. Because otherwise, like I've seen stuff where someone was really trying to push a moral, you know, like some sort of lesson. And it just was like saccharine sweet crap, like oozing off the screen. And you're like, oh, you started with that. And then you tried to find a story that would fit that theme. And I'm like, no. Themes emerge when you're just telling the story naturally. You can't force them. If you want to be a storyteller, go where good stories are being told, right? And even if you're like, oh, I'm not even interested in that. Like, I remember I watched this documentary once on General Tso's chicken. Like, and I'm like, yeah, I've eaten plenty of that over the years. And I put the documentary on. I'm like, I'm giving this 2 minutes. Like, who made a whole documentary about General Tso's chicken? And 2 minutes in, I'm like, I ain't leaving. I'm not leaving this couch because the storytelling was that good. I didn't even care. And they hooked me in. And by the end, I was like, wow. This was awesome. And now I know so much about General Tso's chicken. The next time I ordered it, I'm like, wow, this isn't how they originally made it, but I don't care. I love it. And so like, it's, like, you know, I attend like story slams and stuff where people tell stories from the stage, from like every walk of life about everything. And when you see a story that works, just ask yourself, why does it work? Why did it work on you? Right. Just answer that question. And I think that'll make you a better storyteller. And then just to bring it right back to the paranormal already gives you so much to work with, right? You're talking about the super primal thing, life after death, and all these super huge, you know, heavy subjects that you can explore through so many various haunts and history and things like that. So it gives you plenty to start with. And then at that point, your job is to just serve it, you know, serve it up.
Serve it up with a side of General Tso's chicken.
Yeah. Yes.
Once again, I just want to give a huge thank you to Jeff Bellinger for taking the time to chat with me about paranormal storytelling and the production that goes into some of his work. I also want to thank you for listening. As always, Filming the Supernatural is an Afterlife Road production. If you like what you heard, be sure to rate the podcast 5 stars and give it a follow so you can be notified when brand new interviews get released.